Hello, everybody. I'm Cody.
And I'm Brent.
And we are the Hugonauts, here to review and discuss for you the best science fiction novels of all time. This week, we are discussing Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie and a little bit of the entire trilogy after that. We're going to do that spoiler section thing we do sometimes. So after similar book recommendations at the end, we'll jump into that. But we will warn you in case you don't want the trilogy to be spoiled for you. Also, next week, or in 2 weeks, our next episode will be on Paolo Bacigalupi's The Wind-Up Girl, which we're excited to talk about as well. And one more piece of housekeeping. We'd like to ask everybody, if you have the time this week, to go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and just give us a 5-star rating. It really turns out it really helps us find listeners and helps listeners find us. And it's totally a shameless ask, but that is content creation, isn't it, Brent? That's showbiz, baby.
Showbiz, the showbiz of making podcasts in your basement.
Yeah, that's showbiz. That's exactly. All right. Well, with that said, let's hear a summary of Ancillary Justice, Brent.
Yeah, for sure. I'm so excited to do this one. This is like one of my favorite books the last, I don't know, what's it been since this came out? 10 years, but okay, let's do it. So it's 416 pages or 12 and a half hours on audiobook. And it is about Breck, who once was the Justice of Torin, the AI that inhabited a huge starship and the thousands of ancillaries that were on board. And ancillaries are human bodies that have been taken over by an AI. And those human bodies are basically slaves that were taken in previous Raditch annexations or colonizations of new planets. The people who sort of rose up against them and tried to fight back, they turn them into ancillaries for future invasions. And then the AI can control those human bodies, all with one mind. Anyway, however, now Breck has been reduced to a single human, ancillary body. And that's happened because of this act of treachery that we'll talk about a little bit that's happened. And someone has killed like all the people who mean the most to her. And she's closing in on the end of a 20-year quest to get revenge. And that's kind of where we jump in. So that's the setup.
Yeah, it is.
Hold on. I forgot a thing. Here's the book.
Oh, yeah.
By my face.
You haven't done that. You've forgotten to do that for a while.
I have. Yeah, but this time I have.
That's showbiz, baby.
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, this book is fantastic. We both reread it for this because you and I had read this a long time ago, near when it first came out.
Yep.
And so a long time before you started doing the podcast, we both reread it.
I
reread
the trilogy. I should mention the awards. That's like why it was so noteworthy. It won the Hugo, the Nebula, and the Locust, or the Arthur C. Clarke. One of the other, it won 3 of the big 4 sci-fi awards, basically all in 1 year, which is a big, big deal.
Yeah, because the other two won Locus, so maybe it didn't. 3 out of 4, and it was also Anne Leckie's first novel, so that's amazing, frankly. Because I give this book a 4 out of 5. I think it is, it's got a very compelling plot, compelling characters, and the world building is really great. And I like the exploration of identity she does through the ancillaries and the idea of one mind spread out among numerous bodies, and how that relates to us, and, the speculations on it. It's a very good book.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Super good book. I'll also give it a 4 out of 5. Super gripping. There's a couple of like really new and compelling ideas, which we'll talk more about. The characters are great. The dialogue is good. The good political intrigue. It gets a little bit overly complicated and like wrapped up in itself a little bit. And it's a little slow to get started. Those are sort of the things that took it away from a 5 for me, but I highly recommend this book. I think it does so many things right. I will say, we'll talk a lot more about the sequels in the the post-spoiler section. We'll talk about what happens, all that kind of stuff. But for now, I will also just say I personally liked the two sequels significantly less. I thought this book was like really fantastic and I'd recommend it to anyone. Not so much for the next two.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we can just address that now because I know we're going to address that down the line. But I think the core of the issue comes down to what it's called. It's called a trilogy, and I think it should be called a series. And if it were called a series, because I just reread the entire trilogy, so it's my second reading of all of them. And I think that's the issue because they start to feel it is a continuation of the story, but they start to feel a little bit more episodic rather than a trilogy, which to me necessitates some sort of like master overarching plot that kind of resolves itself among the three books. And this is more just kind of a continued story that's really, really good. But if they called it a series, I wouldn't have been looking for that trilogy feel, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, we'll talk about this a lot more later on, but I also think a big part of it is the amount of time she had. You know, she worked on the first book for 10 years and then it was hugely successful. And then she wrote each of the next two, like your publisher's trilogy idea is back here, right? She spent 10 years on one book, had a lot of success, and then got offered, I assume she got offered a great contract with big advances to write books fast. And so she wrote each of the successive books in 1 year. And that's just a lot harder. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Ancillary Justice really stands alone. And the other books are continuations of the story, but it doesn't necessarily feel like the reason we're reviewing it just as a single book instead of as a trilogy is because it really does stand alone in its own right. It's not like there's a ton of loose ends at the end of book one.
That note, what'd you think about the plot sort of in the first book?
Yeah, we've got like a really, maybe after the beginning a little bit, like you said, but we've got two very kind of swift moving parallel plot lines. We see this all over the place. Like in Project Hail Mary, we talked about last time. But you've got the flashback timeline that is delivering some of the character and history of why, of the motivations of our main character, Breck, or Justice of Torin 1-esque, in the current timeline.
Yeah, for sure. That flashback to when it was Justice of Torin and was a whole ship and had all the ancillaries before the payoff of that timeline is like, what happened? Why is it just one human body now? What happened to it and all the people that were aboard? I agree. That was great. I will say I was really surprised on reading because I had such warm memories of this book. And then as I picked it up and started rereading, it actually took me a while to get into it. And I also had tried to lend this book to a friend who never finished it. And I was always kind of like joshing him, you know, I was like, dude, come on, this is a great book. What's going on? And now picking it up and rereading, I wish I had just given him the advice, like, hey, I know it starts slow, but you just have to work through it a little bit. And just sort of let all the sort of confusion about like what's happening a little bit kind of sit there for a moment. Cause it does come together and start getting really, really propulsive, but it does take a minute to get there.
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of well-written books or well-done media in general. Movies, TV shows can do this too. But to get really good show, don't tell world building and character building, you just kind of, in these types of books, I feel like a lot of times you just have to kind of let it wash over you and be along for the ride and not try too hard to be like, what exactly did that word mean here to that sentence? You just kind of let it wash over you and trust the author and it will come. And I feel like it does here.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll say for me, it really started to like, I the thing that hooked me in, and this is early enough, I feel like we can just talk about what happened in the past timeline. You get to see the emperor of the Rad Kai, Anandar Nai.
Radcha-I.
See, hold on. So I guess we should talk about this now rather than later. So I read the book and Cody listened to it. And this book, it's really interesting. It has lots of, it's interesting because it feels internally consistent, but all the names are like very different from English. But we discovered when we were doing pre-production that like the sort of shorthands that I had given myself in my like mental image of this book are way different than the way the narrator talked about. Yeah. So what's the empire called in your mind?
There's tons of diphthongs. And I think it's a really cool what she's done. Like, the names all sound very alien, but they're also easy to grasp on. Like, she rode that line of making believable names that feel alien, but that you can also remember. I think she did that well, but yeah, tons of diphthongs, whatever. Maybe it was a lot easier listening to it, but the it's called the Ratcha'i.
Ratcha'i. Okay. I'm probably going to keep saying it the way it is in my head. And so apologize to all the listeners. You'll pick which one you like, I guess. Because I probably won't be able to flip totally out of my mental representation.
But I mean, the one that I thought was funnier between us was, there's Anander Miantnai, or Anander Miantnai.
Yeah, the emperor.
Like the silent T, basically. But what was your take on that name?
Anander Miantnai. Mine's much shorter, I'll say that.
You just took out a bunch of vowels to make it easier on your brain.
Well, there were so many. Anyway, yeah okay.
It's fair.
So, okay, but as I was saying, so in that, when we meet the emperor for the first time, it becomes very clear that something really shady is happening, and the emperor themselves is involved. And you find out then, again, early in the book, so I feel like this is okay, that in fact, Breck's quest in the future is to kill the emperor of the empire, which is just exciting and great. And so from there on, basically, I was totally hooked.
I felt kind of the opposite. I felt like the Orr stuff was... a little bit, I didn't feel like it was slower in general. I did not enjoy it or feel like I was slow reading it. It was just more like character development and political conversation. And I actually felt like the stuff on Planet Nil, the present timeline, was really engaging right away. There's a lot of mystery there. But regardless, both of us felt like there's just a little bit at the beginning you gotta punch through. It's totally worth it. And maybe you'll just love it anyways, because we each liked different parts of the beginning. So
yeah, who knows? Sure. Yeah, and there's just one other thing I would say about the plot, which is there are a lot of like the explanations for why things are happening certain ways, whatever. There's just a lot of really complicated stuff that happens, and it feels too complicated, basically. It's a little hard to follow sometimes and feels a little bit, not contrived, but just unnecessarily complicated. And it does, I think that's the slow beginning and the complexity, and then just a couple of like sort of major plot points that, again, we'll talk about in the no spoiler section, that kind of like just don't totally gel. But other than that, amazing plot, super propulsive. Like, the plot is definitely one of the very strong points of this book.
Yeah, totally. I also didn't really feel like that too much, but maybe I'm not judging it correctly. I could have felt like that 6 years ago when I read it for the first time. Maybe I don't, it's easier to say that on a reread. Like, no, I wasn't confused at all.
I think my
you've already read it.
Yeah, there was also the, I think a good example of this is like the stuff that happened at Ime. So in the book there's this event that sort of happens off screen. That exposed a bunch of corruption.
Has
in the
a
empire.
Lot of implications. Yeah.
Yeah. It has a lot of implications. The thing that I think is a good example of this is they have to, Lucky retells the whole story of what happened like three or four times, which I actually think was necessary in order for it to make sense. But you shouldn't really have to do that. You know what I mean? So I think that's a good example.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I could get on board with that. I guess I could see that. So what about the characters?
Well, I loved the characters. I think there's so much that she got right, character-wise. The thing that's really unique there is like the main character is an artificial intelligence, and a lot of it is exploring like how this AI's emotions work. And then throughout of it, you start to learn that a little bit of that was like programmed in some ways, and it's just, it turns it into a super, super interesting character study that felt really unique. I really, really loved it.
And I also love the idea of exploring the kind of the cognitive dissonance and the shattering of a human mind, like something that we all feel in a metaphysical way as we go throughout our lives at different times. It's more pronounced, sometimes it's less pronounced, but the idea that we're of two minds about something, I mean, there's even that very basic idiom about it, and exploring it as if the mind has many bodies to divide that among. And that is very... a very singular concept. I haven't seen that in any other fiction. even though we have so much speculative fiction about identity, I haven't seen that specific thing explored. And I thought that was, I mean, maybe the main draw of like the character part of this book and the character exploration.
Yeah. And we sort of get to explore how Breck, Justice of Torin, changed from being a ship in all these bodies in one timeline to just one body in the other. And they do behave a little bit differently. And yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. And it's got a good balance too. I feel like between the internal dialogues, like the thoughts of the characters, the actual dialogue and the descriptions of what they're doing, like it's a nice flow of getting of techniques to explore and build one's characters that Lecky found.
Yeah, I totally loved it. Yeah, and I think her dialogue is really, really strong too, with lots of like a lot of subtext. You learn about the characters through the things they say, which I think is really authentic and awesome. That's how we all really learn about people in the world. You don't get to hear their thoughts, right? You just hear what they say. And you get to like see what people's motivations are like. And so I feel like we got to see inside people's heads, but just through what they were saying. And that's very hard, very, very, very hard to do.
I would say that, yeah, I mean, yeah. It's the hardest. That's the pinnacle of writing, right? Is being able to pull that off. In an authentic way. Another piece of this puzzle is that in the Ratch language, a cool piece of world building, everybody is gendered as she. So she, sister, mother, there are no genders. And so there's a little bit of when they step outside of using that language, there's a little bit of discovery.
Yeah, like alien languages, they're still trying to gender them. And it's not like the Radkai don't have, like they have gender. They just place no, like they don't assume any like personality traits or anything comes with that. So they just gender everyone with the same pronoun, she. It was just a cool, interesting, different idea. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's particularly cool because you get a little bit of this world building of the challenge of, particularly it happens in Breck's thoughts, but her stepping into a different language and being worried she's going to be seen as an outsider because she's misgendering people because she can't tell the difference. And in that language, you need to gender them. So it's going to be obvious if you're alien, if you're misgendering them. And so it just adds to the world building element pretty fairly seamlessly done. Once you've again let it wash over you, it really sinks in and is a cool element. Wanna, you know, walk us through kind of our themes here?
There's not a lot. There's a couple of big ones. The one that I think is like most obvious is other than I guess the gender thing, which is sort of an interesting thought experiment, but sort of more explicit in the text is there's a lot about class. There are a number of the characters who are basically, there's like some old thoughts and some new thoughts about how Radkai society should work. And the old thoughts are like, if you're from a rich, important house, you should get the important jobs. And the new sort of reformist thinking is like, it should be a meritocracy. You know, as you'll be unsurprised to hear in a Western book, the good guys are the ones who think it should be a meritocracy, and something I'm very much on board with. But I'll also say it like totally worked on me, you know, even though that's like a thing I think we've all agreed on in the West for like 200 years, it still felt like I was still emotionally like, oh yeah, screw those guys who like think they should have all the good jobs because they're like rich and well-connected, you know? So it still totally worked and felt good.
Yeah, it's more like screw those guys who don't want to work at all and own everything.
yeah, that's
not
right.
Have the good jobs. I think we see that it's also particularly about colonization issues, which are, you know, part of the same umbrella. And obviously the Ratchai have been annexing, is what they call it, different planets, which is basically a kinder way of saying colonizing them. And it's just one of the elements of what Lecky does with her language and talking about the language she's developed for the Ratchai, and it's a really interesting world building technique to see what their language does and doesn't do. Like you have the citizens, as soon as someone is considered Ratchai, they're considered a citizen and everyone else is considered uncivilized, which is not okay. And you don't have to interact with them or treat them like people, but there's no way to parse certain distinctions in their language between a citizen who's acting uncivilized. Like them being called a citizen means that they're civilized, even though a lot of these people are not acting civilized. So it's a cool, she plays with language in really interesting ways there too. And then also explores colonization a little more in depth than we normally see it. We normally see it as like a mechanism to show that people are bad and why we want the good guys to beat them. Because they're doing this thing, but I think she explores a little bit more about the reasons why the colonization is happening, and the nuance of getting a people you're colonizing to be on your side, or the right elements, quote unquote, of that people to be on your side, and how to balance and manage that, and also like how to rebel against it. I think she gets into colonization in a deep level, which is really cool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, what did you think about the like the science in tech here? Anything you particularly liked on that front?
I mean, the main thing to dig into is the omnipresent AI deal. It helps her tell her story, first of all. Just the idea that Justice of Torin has many bodies in the flashback. She's telling another element that's great about Lucky's writing is she's telling a lot of things that are happening simultaneously by saying what's happening next to one of her bodies. So she's kind of, we're looking in on three or four conversations that are happening in different locations concurrently because Justice of Torin has so many bodies. So we can look into whichever experience we want to, whichever one's like convenient for the plot at the moment. And that's definitely a cool element. Otherwise, I don't know. What do you think? There's just stuff.
Yeah,
it's cool.
That's the biggest thing. The other thing I liked was that the AI, both the ships, and then there's also this idea of stations, the AI who runs these big space stations with hundreds of thousands or millions of inhabitants, they can see, they have cameras everywhere. They can see everything. And they also can see all the biomarkers from the people. They have like sensors on the humans. So the AI can almost like, it's very hard to hide anything from the AI because they can see what all the people aboard. They can't see what you're thinking, but they can see the way you react to things and start to figure out the way you think. You know, oh, if you get stressed out or, you know, react in anger to this kind of situation, you must have that kind of thought. You know, you must be that kind of person. And it's a really interesting thought experiment on that. And there's things about that I think are a little unsettling, actually, as we move in a world of more and more surveillance. Like,
right.
Will we be able to read everyone's minds? And what does that do in a dictatorial society? But anyway, it's an interesting way to explore it.
Yeah, and we're on the side of all the AIs in this, so it doesn't have that creepy feeling. Like you could easily flip it. There's a ton of dystopian stuff where you flip it and it's like,
yeah,
you know, Big Brother. But here, those are our friends. Those are the protagonists.
AI are all, like, very benevolent in general. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like that element of the AI too. That they all have some sort of kind of like love loyalty mixture for the people they've been programmed to protect and help. And that's a cool thing. You know, it's a cool way to see, artificial intelligence. Cause a lot of times we see it as evil. And then we have a bunch of other like soft sci-fi trope-y kind of stuff, but there's some cool, you know, the armor.
Yeah. And the main Ratchai technological advantage that's allowed them to conquer the whole galaxy is this sort of impenetrable armor that they have, or is it truly impenetrable?
We'll find out. Right.
But yeah. So that's the main stuff with the science and tech. What about like the broader universe here? What's going on in this world she's built?
You know, we don't need to go into too. I think the world building, like the technical ability she has, is that we've talked about, is really excellent. The actual details, please read and find out. Yeah, it's basically like Empire gobbling up space and finally running into the edges and the limitations.
It's like very Roman Empire-esque, way the Ratchai feel. Yeah.
There is one thing I want to say about the world building, and I'm going to use this book as a platform to say it, because I haven't said it yet, but it happens all over the place. And it really pulls me out of a book. Everyone has stuff that pulls them out of novels a little bit. And it's totally up to that person, and it may not affect other people as much. It really bothers me in science fiction when the music they listen to, and they talk about music a lot, and it's just like almost like the emoji for music as an idea, like the level of complexity of thought that's gone in the music. In this book, we have folk songs. Justice of Torin loves singing songs. That's one of her character traits, but they're all just kind of like short poems that don't really sound like songs. And they're very folk songy in such a far future. In Red Mars, we have like the people on Mars are always going to jazz clubs. In Hyperion, the main guy, I forget his name now, but he plays piano. He plays like classical piano, and they're listening to classical music still. And it just bugs me that no one has gotten inventive about thinking about music and what people would be listening to. Because surely that doesn't, you know, that stuff is already old. Like maybe they're still listening to it, but it's like,
no, Cody, in the year 2300, Mozart is going to come back and take over all of culture. You'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I mean, what was the good example that we thought of? Oh, Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson. They have that sweet under the bridge, like LA punk concert. It's like, okay. I mean, this feels awesome. And,
yeah. And like something with the cyberpunk theme. Yeah.
It's something people would actually listen to. So I just think it's like, it's a little bit silly when people make music up front in their science fiction and don't think at all about how like everything else is futuristic except the music's old. And honestly, same could be said for poetry. Like so many science fiction books where poetry is this high art form that everyone appreciates. And here it is again. It's like, I mean, that's even older than the music genres I'm talking about. No one.
Yeah, I mean, I would go ahead and test that and say I don't know if poetry was ever popular, but
I mean, yeah. The romantic poets, they were popular, like Keats and Browning and okay. the like, but and there were other periods.
And we're not bagging on poetry. Poetry's cool. We're just recognizing the fact that not that many people like poetry, so it's unlikely to be the cultural touchstone of a futuristic society. Sorry, poets. No offense.
That's exactly right. It just doesn't read as realistic that it would be the touchstone. That's like a perfect that was a good, way of putting it.
Cody's a musician. That was a great musician take. I loved that.
yeah. Well, I just finally got another chance to drop it in there.
So what about Anne Leckie herself? Her story is very interesting and inspirational for, I think, me personally, I'll also say. So she started writing this book in 2002, and she worked on it for 11 years before publishing it. And I think that's a testament to like her dedication, how hard it is to break into writing. But also I think part of why this book is so good, I think making really, really, really good art takes a really, really long time. And so as a person who's been writing a sci-fi novel for a really, really long time, I like hearing this story, you know. I mean, she wrote this like incredible book. It's so, I'm just reading it. You're like, oh my God, this is obviously a labor of love and awesome. So I think it's really a good, you know, for all of us aspiring writers out there, I think it's a good reminder to just like, keep working on your thing. You can keep making it better and better.
And I also think it's a great lesson in, a lot of times, especially in Western culture, right, we ascribe timelines to things and compare ourselves to creators of and what their age is and how fast they did something. And she's a wonderful example of just do it. Go create something, make it, put it out there. If it's bad, get better the next time. Just start doing something. Go for it. It's never too late. So I loved that too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And then she's written a bunch of books since. I think you've actually read all of them, right? Like I've just read these, but you've read her a couple other books.
I didn't realize this was her first novel. I just figured she had all these novels because I've read five of her novels. And then it turns out she only has five novels. She has a trilogy, and then she has a book called Provenance, which is kind of a cool take on it's a science fiction book about aliens and humans and artifacts, basically provenance of the artifacts, where they come from. Are they still legit? And then a fantasy novel called Raven's Tower. That's also good. So I hope she comes out with something else soon, because I'll read it too.
For sure. Okay, before we similar books, I think we just had one more point we wanted to talk about, which was you really loved this narrator, right, for the audiobook?
Yes. It is Adjoa Ando, who is an actor. She's in a bunch of stuff. I'm trying to think of the biggest stuff, like Witcher, the Netflix series. And
Bridgerton too, right?
Bridgerton, yeah. So great. Such great voices, switches all over the place, tons of different accents. I couldn't believe it was one person. It sounded like a full cast recording. So this one is definitely like highly recommend on the audiobook front.
Nice.
Yeah. Very cool read.
Cool.
Yeah. So time for similar books. Or is there anything more you wanted to say about Ancillary One?
I think we've hit all the high points. I mean, it's a great book. We've talked a lot about all the different ways it's great. So again, highly recommend everyone read it. So if you love this book, we also recommend the Murderbot series by Martha Wells. If the thing you love about Ancillary Justice is like the AI in a human body who's like very protective of its humans and is extraordinarily competent at murder, then you'll like the Murderbot. It's a little bit less serious, but like definitely feels related.
Yeah, and less serious in its own way. Like it's silly. It's trying, you know, it's trying to be a little more fun. So it's succeeding at that too. It succeeds at one other thing, I think, which is the Murderbot loves television and watching television, which to me makes more sense than a bot who likes folk songs. But another book that you probably like, if you liked Ancillary Justice, or if you like this book, you like Ancillary Justice. Either of the books, well, I mean, you kind of have to read them in order, but the Texcalon series by Arkady Martin, that, you know,
yeah,
very similar, like politics.
Yeah, she's like trying to channel part of Anne Leckie's writing. And I'll say personally, I like Anne Leckie more, but I also appreciate what Arkady was trying to do in those books. It's feels for sure very closely related.
Yeah. With the character specifically, the character writing, the way that you realize the characters. And then we have
Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, which is, yeah, also about an androgynous society, and is set on a winter planet, like one of our two timelines is here. So feels, I guess, plot line related, but just such a good book. I mean, that's one that I recommend it's like to anyone.
Vibe adjacent, like just overall, like the culture of the species.
Yeah.
And they're also all just good books. So read them.
For sure.
Okay, so now we're going to move to the spoiler alert section. Spoiler alert, please, you know, it was great having you if you don't want the spoilers. But if you do, they're coming in 3, 2, go ahead.
Okay. All right, end of Ancillary Justice. Very exciting. So the thing she's been looking for the whole book in the present timeline, it turns out, is this gun that can shoot through armor, through the Red Kai armor. She gets it. She gets to a palace with an Andromenai there, and then tells an Andromenai. An Andromenai, it turns out, has been split into two multiple competing factions, basically, minds.
Andromenai.
There's so many vowels. Just starts shooting various different versions of the emperor, basically. Huge shootout, and a civil war starts because the emperor is forced to like recognize this fact that in fact there are two emperors who have been competing for a long time. They've just both been trying to like pretend they still agree with each other, but in fact they don't. And yeah, that's basically the big final conclusion is Breck succeeds and kicks and, you know, kills a bunch of the emperor, forces the emperor to recognize this thing about herself. And then weirdly gets like, ends up kind of like aligning with one of the emperor sides, like the reformer emperor side. The emperor lets her keep her gun and tells her to, you know, keep helping her out basically. And actually gives her the last name. You should say the last name.
Me and I,
there you go. So that's kind of like the big conclusion of Ancillary Justice.
Yeah. And, this is why it feels like, and probably if you stayed, you know this, or maybe that was a little refresher. The second and third book really take place on her new assignment by the reformer Mian Ai on Adawek Station, which is a station above one of the biggest tea-producing planets. Tea is very important to the Rachai. There's some British Empire, you know, stuff there. But they... and the second and third book take place all on this station, essentially, or in the system it's in. There's like a ghost gate that's introduced that doesn't go anywhere, but like what's going on in the ghost
gate? Do they actually call it the ghost gate?
Yeah, the ghost
gate. I've forgotten that. Isn't that the same exact thing that Arkady Martinet calls the bad gate in that goes to the aliens and takes on? Oh, did I just spoil a different book?
Perhaps.
No, that's not a spoiler. It's okay. That's at the beginning of the book.
Perhaps. Yeah, but I think, maybe it's like an established trope. Feel free to, let us know if you know anything about that. Cause that is interesting. But, the reason, you know, we said earlier that it feels like a series and not a trilogy, is that, it doesn't have a central narrative arc that takes us from book one to book three. You know, I feel like a true trilogy has got like, all right, it's got its book one, and then there's the stuff you still need to wrap up at the end of book one that you're like, what's going to happen? Then book two happens, and it has stuff that wraps up, you know, the subplotty stuff to make you feel like you finished a book, but there's still some lingering doubts about the thing that we learned on, you know, maybe the first 10 pages of the first book. And then by the end of book three, you're realizing you're finding all the coolest things. Like in this case, I was expecting to like meet the Presker, the aliens who are threatening their edge of space, find out more about the Dyson sphere that the actual like tier one premier Rachai live in, that no other Rachai are allowed in. Like Anna-Andra Miatnai, like is the most powerful Rachai we know. And she's kind of tier two. She's expanded out of the system because there's no more space in the original Dyson sphere. So I was like, because it was called a trilogy, I was expecting to kind of learn some of those mysteries. Beyond that,
like, didn't you expect to find out like what happens with the civil war? Like who will win? And it's like, yeah. Oh, well that's not even talked about at all. You just pretend it's not happening.
No, just continue. It just continues.
Yeah.
Yeah. It continues. And you have, you know, there's a lot of action happening in this small space and the books are very
well, less action though than the first one too. That's another one of my complaints. I think like the pacing's not as good.
I don't know. I think they're fine. I think they're just, you know, on reread, I enjoyed them. I enjoyed them both. I think it's just an expectation thing. I think you're expecting an increase because it's called a trilogy. You're expecting an increase in stakes and, new things you're discovering, but there's a lot of stuff to replace that. There's really great characters like the Presker translators, these humans that are grown by aliens to try and translate between the two cultures, but they're really super weird because they're half alien. And then a lot of other good new characters and kind of character exploration. It does get way more into the like savioriness of Justice of Torin, like trying to help the pressed classes on Adawek, but it felt good as a series, but I still want more. And I think it shouldn't be called a trilogy.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you on the fact that the characters are really good in the second and third one, but that was also true in the first book. That's like one of the things I love so much about this is like, it had the great characters and dialogue, but also a bunch of action and like huge plot, huge stakes. And it just felt like that big plot, big stakes, like is just not in the last two books.
I guess you're right. I suppose maybe it was a reread function too, that I was like, I remembered being kind of let down by two and three last time.
So you didn't have the expectations.
When I reread, I didn't have expectations. And when I reread them, I enjoyed them.
Maybe that's a great advice for everybody. Maybe people actually will like it then, which is like, hey, just lower your expectations. Don't expect the, you know, and then they'll be fine.
And we would love to hear if anyone stayed till this point and has read the trilogy, we'd love to hear what you thought about that. Because on the comments or socials or email it, can you give those out again?
Yeah. Comments on YouTube, which is actually where most of the discussion ends up happening about our episodes, it seems. Like, I think people even come from the podcast to comment on YouTube and they want to talk about it. So you can do that, or on Twitter or Instagram, DM us or respond in the thread about the episode, or email is huguenotspodcast@gmail.com. That's all the ways.
Yes. And we'd love to hear what you think, because I've never run into this before. Sometimes it's just a bad, like, disappointing book two and three because they're written too fast. Sometimes they're, this one was a weird in between where I was like, maybe if my expectations were different, and maybe it's even just saying series instead of trilogy, then it would have been a lot better. Who knows?
Who knows?
Either way, that's Ancillary Justice, and then the next books, Ancillary Sword and Ancillary Mercy. Thank you for joining us. And
we'll see you in two weeks for Paolo.
Wind up, girl. Paolo first.
Yes. And then the conference, which will be very exciting. See y'all in Chicago.
So sweet. All right. Later, man.
Bye.